I'm Smith Called Keith, and you're listening to Fuel, where sales and marketing never sounded so good. Visit thefuelpodcast.com for all our shows.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Previously on Fuel.
But at the same time, I jumped on the surfboard. I'm on the wave and I'm not jumping off anytime soon. I think people are turning to podcasts to say, this is how I can stay ahead. Now we've entered a world where the democratization of content creation and media has taken full effect. And we're walking into a new world where there's going to be a dust settling.
It's the only marketing show you'll find that actually gives you an education about whiskey as well at the same time. That's like Boaty McBoatface, but for a football club.
Ah, that's where it is.
Is it Wolfman Jack?
Yes!
This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet fuel.
What is it to drive demand in an economy and in a society and in an environment where resources are finite? And so I think we all have to be very thoughtful about how we choose to grow our businesses and which clients we choose to grow our businesses with.
Welcome to the Fuel Podcast, the new business show, and I'm your host, a Smith Called Keith. Now, we've got royalty in the house this week because advertising legend James Murphy took some time out from his crazy busy schedule to sit down for a conversation about a topic that's close to his heart, why the industry's fallen out of love with itself. Under his watch, his former agency Adam and Eve literally created the tradition of the tearjerker Christmas TV advert, and his love for the industry is self-evident. Now, he could have walked away from it after selling Adam and Eve, but he came back for more, and this is his story. So stick around for some great insights and tips from one of the best in the industry. Fuel is sponsored by new business platform The Advertist. It's got all your new business prospecting managed in one place. Stay on top of all the latest breaking news, insight, people moves, tenders, mergers and acquisitions, blue chip and freshly funded companies, with all the contact data to help drive your next new business campaign. Just email hello@theadvertist.com for a free trial. That's theadvertist.com. And I'll drop a link to The Advertist in the show notes at www.thefuelpodcast.com. Now, I'm sure James would appreciate this, but we're just going to get straight to the point. Just a quick note for you all. When we recorded this show, James was still in nomad mode and his agency, New Commercial Arts, was still in transition and in temporary office accommodation. But I guess if you're going to be sharing offices and Wi-Fi, you might as well be sharing with Ridley Scott's production company. But in the first 10 minutes of the interview, it just seemed like some of the aliens were chewing the wires. But bear with it, because this is a rare opportunity to listen to James at his most relaxed and engaging. Unlike me, I haven't been this nervous for a long time.
Stand by in three.
Welcome to another one of our legendary podcasts. And by legendary, I mean I'm talking to legends, where personalities in the creative industry who really should have better things to do talk to me. The advertising industry pulses, grows, iterates, and evolves at a frantic pace. It's a creative industry, and the people behind our greatest agencies are often restless spirits thriving on change and development, driven by challenge, perception, and interpretation. Running a creative agency requires an ability to understand buying habits, but also to tap into some of the most basic emotions that humans possess. And this is why we sometimes refer to experts in this practice as geniuses. Not everyone can do it, which is why so much of the advertising industry's output is often wide of the mark, and it's why talented agencies are paid the big bucks. Now, my guest this week resides at the very pinnacle of the advertising industry's mountain. Some rarefied air up there for sure. In 2008, James Murphy was CEO of RKCRY&R, itself a highly respected position, and to most, a chance to reflect, look back, and feel satisfied that you've done a fabulous job. But that wasn't enough. James, along with Ben Priest, David Golding and John Forsyth, set up shop as Adam and Eve and immediately became embroiled in a famously documented legal battle. But forged from fire, Adam and Eve went on to crank out some of the industry's most famous campaigns for clients such as John Lewis, where they practically invented the tearjerker Christmas TV ad. Heineken, Cadbury's, Lloyd's, Unilever, GWR, these are just a few of the many national and international brands that have called on Adam and Eve's expertise, and I could literally fill up a whole hour just reciting the client list. Needless to say, when it comes to winning new business, Adam and Eve are the very genesis of success. Five campaign agencies of the year, two Cannes Lion agencies of the year, three IPA Effectiveness Grand Prix, one Gun Report Most Creative Agency in the world, and one Walk Most Effective Agency in the world. And for most podcasts, it would be great to have such a wonderful and high-profile guest on just to recount those glory days and go over that familiar ground. But when he agreed to come on the show, I asked James, what is it that keeps you coming into work each day? What drives you? What is it that you're most passionate about? And can we make a show out of it? Because, among other things, James had every right to walk away satisfied with a job excellently done when he and his business partners exited Adam and Eve DDB in 2019. But no, he came back again with David Golding, again starting another agency, New Commercial Arts, again in the face of adversity, this time in a pandemic, and again winning more new business, Halifax, Money Supermarket, Vodafone and Sainsbury's, just for starters. So let's crack on with the show and chat to James Murphy in Murphy's Law of Agency Life. Welcome to the show, James, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Busy, but in a good way.
And I mean, given the fact we've had two very catastrophic global events to deal with, probably most upheaval most of us have sort of dealt with in our professional lives. I mean, how's that actually changed how you work and run the agency?
Well, I think we're in probably a fairly... we're coming to the end of an artificial and temporary period, I think, in terms of we're nearly at our second anniversary, but actually we're 3 weeks off going into our first proper office. So we've existed for the best part of 2 years as, well, either working from home,
right,
or more recently as nomads, moving around various spaces in central London. And we're currently camped out on the ground floor of Ridley Scott Pictures, and which is good. But within 3 weeks, we'll finally have a place of our own, which would be good. So
lovely.
It's been an interesting couple of years. I think we're obviously now facing a situation where there's a second seismic event sweeping over the global economy,
sure,
the European economy, and obviously the UK ultimately. I'd say probably it's manifest itself for us, probably really just in terms of anxiety at the moment and the sense of foreboding. It's not hit noticeably in terms of business, but that could all be about to happen.
Yes, sure. So obviously, I mean, we'll come on to the acquisition of new business sort of later on. But I mean, when you and I first chatted, I sort of explained that, you know, we wanted to try and go slightly off-piste and sort of talk about some of the things that sit at the core of your belief system. I mean, you explained that one of the issues that gets you kind of all riled up is the fact that the advertising industry seems to have kind of fallen out of love with itself. I mean, you know, the incredible trajectory of Adam and Eve, which I already talked about, but and obviously you're more than happy to mention again, because I would if I was you. But I mean, it's, you know, that history is pretty well known. But, you know, you had the opportunity post the Adam and Eve sort of issue to basically bugger off and get involved in a few passion projects. But I mean, to me, it looks like, you know, this industry is your passion project. And I mean, is it still an enjoyable industry to work in?
we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think it was enjoyable. And that is the reason we're doing it, is because obviously, you know, sitting atop a large and successful agency and being paid well is a reasonably positive situation to be in. But the thing that made us go back to the beginning, start all over again, was actually just really the experience doing this job is exciting and enjoyable,
right?
And endlessly stimulating. And so I think we wouldn't be doing this, and we wouldn't be doing another startup, if it weren't really just for the fact that it's such an enjoyable way to work and to make a living.
And I mean, what was the idea behind when you started it? Because obviously, you know, I mean, you pretty much could write your own sort of business model here. But I mean, what was the idea that was so different behind New Commercial Arts?
I think first of all, agencies, when they start up, often people go, we're totally unique. We've got a business model that no one else has, or a take on the market that no one else has. I don't think actually we've ever claimed that. I do think we do have a difference, but it's actually not really because we've been seeking to be that different. When we were working at Adam and Eve DDB, we experienced working on a lot of clients that had quite retail dynamics to their business. And what we realized is that we're often making promises through our communications work entirely coming to life in terms of the experience of the customers of those brands. But where we did get a chance to influence the customer experience, it was doubly rewarding, was because it was bringing together that a strong, rigorous point of view on communications, but also a point of view on how you make those communications live in the experience for customers. So it's bringing together comms and customer experience.
And so, I mean, when you launched NCA, I mean, is there an end game in mind? I mean, is there an end goal for the business, or are you just going to, you know, see how this all moves?
I think perhaps slightly shallowly, I think see how it moves, because the reason that we started up was probably the starting, not the finishing, if I can put it that way. And, you know, we did the startup because we... in this business, and we thought that there was actually an interesting evolution of the model that we could bring to the market. I think from our point of view is, when things are going well, you have a series of briefs given to you by your clients. There are an endless series of challenges and puzzles to solve. And if you do that well and you work hard at it and you work brilliantly as a team together, then you get more of that work and things grow. So I think it's much better to concentrate on the beginning than it is on the end game, because if you take care of the beginning, the end game takes care of itself.
Yeah, I get it. And you know, obviously, I think it's, you know, it's obviously nice to sort of, you know, to be part of that whole sort of, the initial sort of kickoff time about it. But I mean, you know, the early Adam and Eve days that, you know, you obviously missed. I mean, was there a kind of a, when you came up with the, you know, with the idea to kind of restart as NCA, I mean, were you trying to recapture some kind of fire that you lost at the very start? I mean, do you think that that's part of it, is the passion of starting up?
I don't think it was so much about trying to rekindle any fire. It was about probably looking at it and thinking, last time round, well, Adam and Eve, the first 2 years of our agency's existence had a big dark cloud over it in the form of legal action.
Right.
And this time round, we've been able to really experience that first 2 years without having to have a major distraction like that. It's you have really experience with 4, 5, 6 of you and growing outwards and growing exponentially, really. And to build that sort of familial team or a gang, if you like, is a very, very positive and enjoyable experience. And it's been really, really good to do it this time and to feel our way forward without the sort of threat of major litigation hanging over us.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that you said before that, you know, it's kind of, you know, Adam and Eve came out of, you know, litigation, and now you started NCA at the, you know, the very start of the pandemic. And I was thinking, what with what's going on now in Ukraine and stuff like that, it's probably about time for you to start another business, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, also, I think it might be a cliche, but people do say that recessions and difficult times are often the best time to start businesses.
Yes.
Because you're smaller, you're nimbler, you know, for a myriad of reasons.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. But I mean, you know, obviously, you know, given what I've just referenced and, you know, thoughts tend to turn to, you know, a communist economy and, you know, it kind of highlights the differences between that and a capitalist economy. And, you know, because the advertising industry kind of sits at the tip of the spear in terms of the capitalist economic model, I mean, I wanted to ask you for your views with regards to, I mean, how do you feel that we need to balance the need to drive demand against the sort of politics of the current politics of the environment? I mean, you know, do you sort of balance that equation? And I mean, is there a Goldilocks solution in all that?
Well, I think that the brilliant thing about, you know, living in an economy and a democratic society like ours is that we have freedom of choice. And in terms of running a business, you have no more freedom of choice than when you're a small independent business that can make your own decisions. So we're obviously able to make our own decisions about how we choose to grow and who we choose to work with. And I think there are certain things that we believe in the generally positive direction of a market economy and the fact that promotes ultimately better products, better services, more efficiency, more thoughtfulness, more environmental awareness, because as consumers become open to those things, they demand that from brands.
Right.
Equally, you do have to look at it and go, there's a bigger, more macro question, which is that, you know, what is it to drive demand in an economy and in a society and in an environment where resources are finite? And so I think we all have to be very thoughtful about how we choose to grow our businesses and which clients we choose to grow our businesses with. And there are certainly some things we've been approached by businesses in our first 2 years that we've chosen not to pursue and not to work with.
Right.
I think that's our decision personally as individuals within an independent company. I do think there's a huge amount of preaching going on at the moment, a lot of finger pointing and a certain amount of virtue signaling. It's not my place to point at people and the choices they've made. It's, you know, we have to look to ourselves and make our own choices about who we work with and who we don't.
Yeah. And I mean, I was, you know, I've been talking to sort of several people about this. And I mean, I think that, you know, that given, you know, a not too great a span of time, that a lot of our worries are going to be sort of alleviated by the fact that it's going to be kind of baked into most business models now that, you know, that you don't work, you know, you've got retailers that don't work with sweatshops and there's no worry about that, or that most of their supply chain is, you know, is environmentally friendly and stuff, that it's kind of baked in. And I think, you know, we're now at the moment, we're kind of all watching for it and stuff, and it should be accepted at some point in the future.
I think it's interesting that it happens when a kind of an evolving market economy works in a positive way. It happens at both ends of the chain, because I would say on one end you've got my children saying they don't want to have certain clothing brands because they understand that sweatshirt can't be that cheap unless it's made in a sweatshop,
right,
possibly by someone of their own age. And they have a very clear understanding of that. But then at the other end of the chain, when we pitch for clients, we're often put under quite intense scrutiny in terms of our working practices, in terms of our environmental standards,
right,
our standards of how we treat, train and develop staff, and where we source certain things like energy or materials from. So in a sense, those are examples of a market economy working in a positive way, where knowledge is shared and there's a certain level of transparency, and that manifests itself both in terms of individual consumers like my children or me buying on their behalf, and also clients buying from us in a market like ours.
And I mean, you mentioned, I just want to pick you up there, because you mentioned the the subject of staff and sort of bringing new staff on and stuff. And we in a previous conversation that we had, you said that, you know, something that you missed, you were referencing, obviously, you know, sort of working remotely and stuff, was that having everybody around you together working as a team was very important to, you know, to an agency, and that, you know, it's kind of critical in your view to how it grows. And I think you kind of humorously said that, you know, it was about having a local watering hole and stuff to go to. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you did rather hilariously describe yourself as being the sort of antithesis of laddish. But I mean, you know, what role does a social life of the advertising agency play into its growth?
I think it's, I mean, I grew up in the industry at a time when agencies were super social environments. And, you know, it was every day, certainly when I was a grad and in those sort of early years, every day I had a trip to the pub, and then you'd often go out for a pizza afterwards and things like that. And as a younger person, single, being in London for the first time properly and so on, my agency life formed a large part of my life outside of work, particularly during the week. And I think you can see that during the pandemic period, probably the people who've suffered most have been the younger members of the agency, who, again, because they don't have a family that they're kind of growing. They don't have a house that they're living in with a partner and,
right,
and so on. They're often, they will be looking to work as a source of at least some of their social energy, and I think that's been denied them. And I think now things have unlocked somewhat, and now we're approaching having our first proper agency space, if you like. I think things like having a good local pub are important.
Yeah.
Things like having good local coffee shops and restaurants and takeaways are important. But I think the crucial thing is that people feel that when they're at work, they're amongst people who are friendly and supportive and care about them, care about doing a good job together. And I think that agency life has always offered one of the more dynamic and social environments to work in. I've got plenty of other friends who work in other industries, things like journalism or law and so on. Those always feel like much lonelier professions to me than working in an agency, because the thing about what we do is I don't think you can achieve very much on your own in an agency, because at our best, we work in quite broad, diverse, multifunctional teams where different people with different skills and different characters and personalities come together. And it takes that sort of diversity to create the alchemy of the best work that agencies do.
Right.
And so I think we're very lucky, because they're social environments, but I think the process of how we work together is inherently quite social, quite gregarious and expressive. And I think it's become more that way. The industry I grew up in was much more egotistical and macho. And, you know, there were gurus and they were the people that knew best because they'd won a gold at, you know, some obscure awards ceremony several years ago. So, you know, their word was law. And you look at it now, I think it's a much more open, democratic, energetic, and in a good way, sort of disrespectful industry. At its best, our industry has always been quite disrespectful and iconoclastic. And I think we definitely need to be disrespectful of the kind of overbearing egos that have dominated certain parts of the industry in the past.
Yeah, okay. Well, no names mentioned, obviously. But okay, so obviously the idea behind Fuel is that we'd like to talk about agency growth and how agencies build themselves, and of course that's the Fuel. If anyone who follows you sort of sees your name and wants to sort of receive some of your wisdom, I mean, is there a a science to the way that you approach new business? I mean, is there a sort of a methodology that you use, or a sort of an algorithm that you apply or whatever? And if so, I mean, is that something that continues to work for you, or are you adapting that?
I would say probably we're unscientific about it, except that probably we don't pitch for much, but when we do pitch, we sort of go all in. Right. And I think that's a very deliberate decision. I think there are other people, and there are other agencies that certainly I see that operate the opposite model entirely. They will pitch for anything that moves on the basis that it's a numbers game.
Right.
And if you kiss enough frogs, some of them will turn into princes. And it's, I think for us, and certainly this is very true when I think you're small and growing. I think you have to choose your pitches carefully. And then, as I said, sort of go all in on them. And certainly when we were building Adam and Eve, I'd say it sort of grew in a kind of staircase, in the sense of you'd have these periods where you'd pitch for several things and then you'd level off. You'd win them and then bed them in and level off. And then you'd go out and pitch again for another period. Excuse me, just switch off the phone. And it's very... I think the view would be that kind of staircase model is a good way of growing, because it allows you to pitch intensely, then pull the shutters down for a bit while you bed in and start to deliver your first work for them before you then go back out. And, you know, other agencies are, you know, there are some very successful, very big agencies in our market that pitch, you know, we might
relentlessly.
I'm trying to think. I think we pitched for 5 things last year. There are competitors pitch for 35. I think that's, I would much rather work really, really hard on 3 or 4 pitches,
right,
than do a 90% job on 20 pitches but not win them.
Right.
Because you end up wearing out and making lives a misery to no end when you do that.
And so, I mean, okay, so you say you pitched for 5 bits of business last year. I mean, yeah. How many of those were successful?
4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. Okay, that's not too bad.
4 out of 5. And so 8%. Yeah.
Good.
And the truth is, if I'm being hard on myself, we shouldn't have done the 5th. That was a mistake.
Okay.
That was a bad choice on our part. Yeah.
Oh, so, well. Well, you live and learn, right?
But I think it's interesting, because there's been a certain amount of commentary in this market and in the industry press about has the pitching market has it become a little bit tainted? Is something wrong with it, and so on? And I definitely think we probably need to tighten up the way we approach pitching as an industry, as agencies, because we certainly, that particular pitch we wandered into very naively. You know, it was a client that was talking a big game and wanted a big step change and so on. And basically, you know, pitched 4 very, very world-class agencies out of 5, and then chose probably the weaker of the batch, and then did something very, very weak in terms of the work, and whilst also announcing, by the way, the appointment was only for 12 months. None of that was communicated at the beginning of the pitch. It was going to be a long-term relationship, building a brand over years with strong work. And actually, I think probably agencies need to be more inquisitorial at the beginning of pitch process. And what are you looking for? What kind of relationship do you want? And I think, I know it sounds vulgar, and particularly in the British market, people don't like talking about this, but how much have you got? What do you want to spend on your media, on your production, on your, you know, relationship with your agency? And I think we balk at asking those questions. And I think, or if we do, we're to be fobbed off.
I mean, do you think that is a British quirk? It's just this resistance to talk about money.
I'm not sure it's just culturally British. I think that we probably suffer from excessive enthusiasm when it comes to pitching. I think people get excited about pitches and they want to run into them enthusiastically, full of brimful of passion, and they don't want to sort of somehow create a bum note with the client early in that pitching process by asking about money and so on. I think that look at it and go, actually, I'm pretty sure most clients have a clear idea about what their broad plan is,
right,
and what their broad budgets are. And too many times agencies get all the way down through the pitching process. They pitch for their lives to get this stuff. And the clients you're pitching to will often very politely step back and unleash their procurement people on you. And the procurement people will have you and one other agency. You both pitch for your lives. So at that point, you're going, well, you don't want to waste all of that effort. So you're then negotiating from a position, certainly of emotional weakness, I would say. And I think we need to get much better about getting clarity on some of those things.
It's a good observation.
And one thing that does help that is, well, and in some cases, pitch consultants will really help with that, is that they provide that sense of rigor and transparency. And they will say to a client, so be clear about what your aspirations are, be clear about what your practical things like timings and budgets are, and also be clear about the politics of your organization and the market that you operate in. So it's a prime example where often having a sort of professional intermediary can really, really help.
Oh, that's a good piece of advice. Yeah, I think that's handy to get your take on that. And I mean, just very quickly, James, talk to me about Glasgow. I mean, because I mean, you touched on this sort of in our first conversation, and I mean, I was fascinated by it. So, I mean, how does Glasgow fit into the business model here?
So, I mean, Glasgow was on one level. Perhaps looks a bit like an impetuous decision, which is that before we've even got an office in London, we've opened an office in Glasgow. And but there's a really simple reason for it. And a lot of people say, oh, have you got clients up there or something like that? And actually, it's nothing to do with that. It's entirely driven by talent. That I'd begun talking with Glasgow School of Art and Design and degree courses that were really, really training people brilliantly for this particular model that we had in mind, which was thinking strategically and creatively about brands and how they communicate, but also how they exist in customers' lives in terms of the experience that they offer customers. And they train people brilliantly in that way of thinking. But a lot of those people graduate from Glasgow and they don't want to come down to London.
Right.
They don't, you know, the life down here doesn't appeal to them and so on. And I think our sense was, well, there's a real reservoir of some brilliantly talented people there. So why don't we open up an operation there? That will give them somewhere that they can work in without having to come down to London. And we were all working remotely anyway at that point. So it didn't really make much difference to the dynamics of how we work together. I think that now we're establishing a proper hub in London. I think that it will carry on being quite a loose, open way of working together.
It sounds wonderfully kind of organic rather than, you know, sort of there's some big master plan, you know, written down. It seems that, you know, it's very much driven by instinct and sort of creative desire and stuff. So I think it does sound very good.
Well, I think we also operate in a market. I think you have to be organic to an extent, because actually, I mean, some people might disagree with it profoundly, but I think we are shaped so much by our clients and the clients that choose to come and work with us. And so I don't think you can have this sort of set in concrete business plan or this trajectory for, you know, in the first year our revenue will be this and our profit will be this and in year two it will be this. I think you enter a market that's extremely vibrant, in many ways oversupplied, hyper competitive, and you have to just forge your way into that with as much positive energy as possible, and you have to course correct as you go along. I think that I don't think you can have too rigid a model. And that's probably one of the reasons that the industry has evolved such a Darwinian kind of dynamic, where small agencies are deemed to be sort of energetic and kind of nimble, uh-huh. and large agencies atrophy and then become stale. And actually, I think what not all large agencies do. I mean, I would say that Adam and Eve is a large agency that's continued to be vibrant and dynamic. And that's partly because I think it was not very doctrinaire as an agency. Some agencies, when they get big, feel they somehow have to look into themselves and say, right, what is it that we do? And what is it that makes us unique? And how do we codify that? And you can see those agencies becoming rigid, and then they become bound up with processes, and then they sort of work with a myriad of clients, but try and force them all into one way of working. And I think one of the blessings of this industry is that you get to work with so many different types of businesses and people and talents. So why be doctrinaire about how to approach it?
Yeah, you know, that's a very, very interesting point, because, you know, so many agencies, I mean, obviously approaching things from a business development perspective, as I always tend to do, you know, so many agencies make a big play about their process and their, you know, their 1, 2, 3 steps that we always go through and all that sort of thing. And, you know, as you've quite rightly identified, it's not every client wants to go through that. You know, they like to work differently.
Well, and I think the thing is that generally when clients come to you, particularly at the pitching stage, they're coming to you with a problem. So the idea that it would always be a solution of 1, 2, 3 steps seems pretty arrogant and quite rigid, I think. And as I said, one of the things that I love about, you know, when you go to that pitch from the client is you never quite know what to expect. You know, they may come to you and say, you know, we've got quite a lot of success, but we're worried momentum. We want you to keep that momentum going. Or they may be coming to you and saying, we've got a ton on our hands, you know, one's entered the mark and it's out at the knees. And I think that's very exciting. But what it doesn't need is a rigid philosophical approach that doesn't bend from an agency. You look at that proof and you go, how do we crack this? What's the way that we approach this to get to the most powerful solution?
Right. No, well, that makes a lot of sense. I want to talk to you about making people cry, all right, because this seems to be a specialty of yours. You know, back in the early days, I mean, would it be fair to say that you did actually invent the Christmas tearjerker ad? Because I can't remember anything before that with the John Lewis model.
I think probably John Lewis did blaze that trail. And I mean, Christmas ads prior to that, and I did Christmas ads prior to that for people like M&S and so on.
Yeah.
And they were, I mean, with M&S, it was magic and sparkle. It was boisterous and uplifting and not melancholic in any way whatsoever. And I think probably the John Lewis thing we hit on partly because of the uniqueness of that brand.
Yeah.
Because it has such a strong, powerful, enduring relationship with its customers through their lives and through their families' lives. And that was what that was the truth that led us in that direction.
Well, I mean, because you have literally, I mean, you've created a genre out there. I mean, that's a given. But I mean, are they still, I mean, do you think there's still room for that as a category? And I mean, do the ads of that you, I mean, you must sit there and look at these ads and think, yeah, well, it's still not as good as the, you know, the ones that we did. I mean, do you think that there's still a sort of a need for those, and are they as good as they used to be?
Well, I think it's difficult because within 2-3 years of us creating that genre, if you like, for John Lewis,
yeah,
a lot of other brands started following suit. And so I think it's difficult now to tell the John Lewis ads apart from the non-Jewish John Lewis ads as such, because there are so many other brands doing narratives in their advertising. And but I think also I'm wondering whether, you know, in some senses, our market, particularly in the UK, you can almost look at there are sort of styles of creativity that seem to change every decade or so. I mean, I always felt that in a way that BBH sort of absolutely dominated the sort of mid-80s through to the mid-90s with advertising that was effectively like brilliant music videos and
yep.
stuff for things like Levi's and Audi and so on. And then I think, you know, Fallon were an agency that almost set the tone for the UK industry for probably the best part of a decade with work that was very driven by with color and vibrancy, things like Sony Balls,
and
Cadbury Gorilla that had these really, really kind of boisterous joyfulness to them. And perhaps they also had this, I think they created it, they had a number of kind of South American creative talents that perhaps contributed to that sense of lust for life and in the work and so on. And then perhaps we stepped in following that at Adam and Eve with that slightly more melancholy kind of storytelling with a very kind of poignant use of music and so on. But that's, what, 12 years ago that started. So, and as I said, there'd been a lot of people copying it since.
And I mean, it almost seems to me that, you know, sort of if you were to, that you kind of came in with a almost a Britpop approach to, you know, to the world of advertising. And, you know, I mean, sort of if we're going to make the, if I'm going to make those kind of analogies, I mean, I would very much draw, you know, the analogy towards someone like in Britpop, Pulp or Blur or someone else like that, in sort of the intelligent kind of version of normal rock and roll. Sort of thing.
Well, I think the I mean, I think if we could be accused of anything, it's probably being a bit overly sentimental and a bit overly sensitive and thoughtful in some of our work. I think the you know, if you compare it back to, you know, if you compare a John Lewis type narrative to something like Cadbury's Gorilla, they're different.
Yeah,
you know, we would be the sensitive indie people, you know, listening to our Cure album in our bedroom on our own. You know, the Cadbury's Gorilla people would be sort of bouncing around in the pub to a rock and roll jukebox.
Nicely put. Nicely put. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, you set up NCA and you've got it going. I mean, what was the, in the sort of, if you could give me a sort of a fly on the wall sort of narrative here, I mean, what kind of priority did you give generating new business? I mean, presumably, you know, there were clients that wanted to come with you anyway, but was there any kind of picture about how you were going to move on from that? Was that, you know, sort of planned for?
I think back to my point about sort of business plans and business models. I mean, this will sound perhaps slightly flip or irresponsible, but there wasn't a big kind of business plan as such. There was an idea that we felt that we had a service offer to take to the market that would be interesting. And it was kind of a balance of proven quality of thinking and creativity, but with a new perspective that was more customer experience orientated.
Right.
And I think that we felt that if we could build that offer, that some people would come. And the thing is that in launching a marketing services business, the barriers to entry aren't very high. You know, you need probably five or six of you with complementary skills, probably more now, probably about nine of you, given the breadth of channels.
All the different disciplines, yeah.
Yeah, you probably need about nine people and at least a couple of laptops and somewhere with a good Wi-Fi signal. And I think you can start. I mean, we started Adam and Eve in the corner of a place called the Breakfast Club around on D'Arblay Street.
Yep.
And because they had, you could sit there with one coffee for hours and hours, and they had a really strong Wi-Fi signal. So it worked really, really well. And I think with... Obviously, this time we started NCA in spare rooms and bedrooms and things like that. And the, you know, the power of your Wi-Fi signal was equally important. But it was a situation where, because you can start with such low overheads, if you like,
right,
you're in a situation where if you can get one or two things in terms of new business, one or two clients to work with you, you're very quickly covering your costs because your costs aren't very much.
Right.
But I think, and that's true as long as you take what we did, which is quite a Spartan approach to launching, and we did with Adam and Eve, which is, you know, no fancy offices, no, you know, swivelly chairs or expensive handmade desks from Italy or anything like that. It's, you know, I think there's a certain joy in the really, really stripped back, efficient way that you can start a business in our industry and so on. And certainly, you know, you do see some people, and less so now, I think, because I think people are much more thrifty and I think frugal in the way they create their agencies and so on. I remember when we launched Adam and Eve about 6 months in, when we were moving to our first proper office, having borrowed a room from someone, we needed some furniture and we went round and someone said, oh, there's an agency around the corner that's going bust and they're having to get rid of all their furniture. And I had this strange experience of going around there and the MD of that agency gave me a sheet of stickers, little red dots. And I had to go around and put red dots on the furniture that
like,
we were going to buy.
Like an estate sale.
Their people were finishing their jobs.
Oh, no.
But I was astonished when I went into the agency. I mean, it didn't look like an agency that was going out of business.
Right.
It was a big office with a beautiful marble reception and things like that. And I was thinking, how on earth could this be a startup? And you know, there were founders that all had corner offices with PAs outside and so on. I think there's a certain sort of enjoyment and positivity now in the way that you can enter this market in quite a streamlined and Spartan way. Or perhaps that's just me.
No, I think it's a great approach, and I think that you know the grandiose days of the big corner office and stuff are you know, I think what you're doing is very reflective of the, you know, the times, and people are having to sort of, you know, pull in their belts a little bit more and to adjust their costs. And I mean, and talking of that, I mean, you know, I can't have you on the show and not discuss the very thorny issue of kind of agency fees and stuff. I mean, how do you respond to the idea that, you know, the fee structure, the current industry fee structure, is a kind of a race to the bottom? I mean, does it need over reviewing, or have you found new and interesting ways to work with clients on fees?
So I think that I'm not sure I sense a race to the bottom. I think I mentioned earlier, I certainly sense, I can understand why there's a certain amount of disquiet in the industry right now about some of the pitching practices and process that has come into play through the back end of the pandemic.
Right.
But I would also say it feels pretty clear that if you can be selective about the clients you pitch for and be quite and scrutinize them before you commit. So you work out, are they serious? Is it, are these marketeers that believe in long-term partnerships with their agencies and so on, that there is still business out there that is lucrative and that where people want to pay properly for proper work and thinking, it is still there. But I mean, equally, there's obviously that because we're in an evolving industry in technology terms, there are also many more calls on a client's budget. So, you know, if we're developing strategy and comms and customer experience, we also have to think about and be aware of competitors in areas like performance marketing, where they on the surface will offer much more, how can I put it? They can guarantee a certain return. You know, give us £500,000, we'll guarantee you £600,000 back.
Yes, yeah.
But the absolutely amazing thing about our industry is that we can say, give us £500,000, we could turn it into £50 million. And because when you get the alchemy of strategy and creativity and experience right, the multiplier is so effective for brands that, you know, that the return you can generate to the client leaves you feeling, my God, we should have been paid 10 times as much. But we can't guarantee that in the same way as someone with a pure performance marketing background can do that. So you're then reliant on how ambitious is your client or how confident they feel within their own organization. If they can say to their finance director, I want this budget, I believe we can at least get this return, we might get a much bigger multiple on it though, then you're in a good place. If they go, I have to be able to say to my finance director, give me the 500 grand, I promise you I'll make 600 grand, then, you know, you're dealing with a different animal at that
point.
It's
a different, yeah, it's a different math, a different set of maths that goes over the whole thing. No, that's great. And really good advice. Thank you, James. That's really sort of excellent, excellently put. We did a few shows recently. I want to talk about the sort of D&I, and obviously I know it's a subject that's close to your heart, and where, you know, we had a few shows discussing the sort of socioeconomic disparity in the creative industries. I mean, firstly, I mean, do you think that the creative world is doing enough to promote itself to a more diverse pool of talent from a recruitment perspective? And then, I mean, how do we deal with the bigger issue of retention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no doubt that the industry is doing more to promote itself to a broader range of people from a broader range of backgrounds, but there's still a lot more to be done. Because as someone that's recruiting, yep, and recruiting pretty consistently as we grow, there simply isn't the pipeline of people from broad enough backgrounds to feed a genuinely diverse industry in the future. Now we're doing a lot to bring in people from what I would call less traditional ad agency backgrounds, particularly at the entry level, and then committing to develop them and train them for the long term.
Right.
Because anyone that's trying to hire at the mid or upper levels in the industry will know there's a very, very finite number of people who don't come from that kind of cookie cutter background. And I think that the thing that we have to do is, I think, be very aware of the commitment and the long-term commitment it takes to make real change.
Right.
It's not about making gestures and kind of statements that you can get a really positive headline in the industry press with. You're going to have to dig in for 5, 10, 15 years to develop people, grow them, get them into positions of seniority, and then the situation will become self-reinforcing in a totally positive way.
That's great. Fantastic. And I mean, you know, obviously it's a big thing that we've been talking about as far as the industry is concerned, in terms of the retention aspect of it. And I think that, you know, that if you create the right environment, and, you know, for people to flourish, and you obviously seem to be so super aware of this as an employer at the moment as well. I mean, things have changed, haven't they? I mean, in terms of what people are looking for from an employer these days.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say, in a sort of mea culpa sense, we haven't created the right environment yet, because we haven't got our own environment. Is that our environment changes every few weeks when we move,
right?
And I think we are, but we're thinking long and hard about what we want our first proper space to be and how we want it to work. And I think we need to be very vigilant in the sense of creating an environment that is exciting and energetic and developmental for the people in that environment, but is also thoughtful and sensitive to whether people are feeling, whether positive momentum and energy has suddenly become something that perhaps is a bit more overwhelming or all-consuming. And because it's very easy for some of us to get super excited about, you know, growth and pitches and creative opportunities. And I think you have to be aware that some people can get run over in that situation if you're all full of adrenaline and charging forward, and not everyone wants to move at the same pace, and not everyone wants to contribute at the same volume. And I think we need to be much more thoughtful about how we create an environment that allows people to contribute in their own way. I think we've always been very good at creating very open and debating, perhaps even argumentative environments where they're very, very democratic. This idea that, you know, we don't like the idea of gurus or prophets or things like that, that many of the best ideas we've ever had the privilege to work on and develop have come from people in unusual corners of the business or the different disciplines and, or, you know, some people who are really inexperienced and superficially junior. So democracy and allowing that openness is really, really good. But equally, when it just becomes very, very opinionated and argumentative, some people don't feel that they can contribute.
Right.
And they feel perhaps a bit oppressed and a bit intimidated by that environment. So we have to make sure that people can, how can I put it, let their magic out, if I can put it that way. And people do that in different ways.
That's great. And of course, obviously, as you said, you're about to sort of create your own environment and your own space. So, I mean, that's coming up. I was going to ask you basically what's coming up in the not too distant future for you, but I guess an office move is going to be number one for you.
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple of things in terms of the office move and how that manifests itself culturally, because it's our first chance to really put roots down and create the dynamics of what we want to be as a growing business. Yeah. And a growing team of people. We've got three or four pretty exciting new business things in the offing at the moment, and we're hoping that those will convert.
Good.
And that would be a great coincidence if they can kind of come together at the same time as us having this space. That would be a really good sort of graduation point, I think, for us as a group of people after 2 years of this itinerant sort of nomadic existence.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you very much for that, James. That's really, really great. But now on to the sort of final furlong of the show. And we like to ask our guests basically a bit of sort of R&R, some R&R questions. In terms of hobbies and interests, I mean, when you're not sort of running sort of creative agencies and stuff like that, I mean, how do you like to relax and switch off?
I think it's probably going to be quite a boring answer. I've got three young children, so basically when I'm not working, that's what I'm doing.
Your dad.
And yeah, and I mean, I love that. And I think one of the, for someone of my age and stage with young children, that was obviously probably one of the big upsides of the lockdown. Was that you got to spend so much time together. And I would say that one of the biggest challenges about the end of lockdown and coming back out to work has been that separation from, we all got used to being together an awful lot. And I think so far I've noticed myself being much better at getting home and spending
right.
more time and being hopefully a better parent. So it's a boring and slightly worthy sounding answer, but you know, they won't be young for long, you know, and I really enjoy that contrast with the life of work. And that's probably it. That's all I have time for.
Just being a parent after that. Yeah, fine. And yeah. Okay. So, show and tell. Were you able to bring something along that that has a deep sense of meaning and importance to you?
Do you know what? I didn't bring it, but I do know what it is.
Go on.
And well, basically, it's every piece of music that I own, whether that's my vinyl,
your music collection,
whether it's my dusty CD collection or my increasingly sort of encyclopedic digital bank of music on my phone and so on. And you know, I think that I think we're in an industry where a lot of people are absolute music nuts and so on. And I love music. I mean, it's probably no coincidence that a lot of the work that we've done, perhaps some of the better work that we've done, has been quite rooted in powerful use of music and so on.
Right.
Because I think my partners and the people I work with are all hugely passionate about that kind of thing. So I'd say it's music.
It's your music collection.
I think you also asked, did I have a record or something?
Yeah, well, that brings me nicely onto that. Go on.
Yeah, there's one at the moment that I really love, which is called I Don't Live Here Anymore by The War on Drugs. And
okay.
They're a really good band, and I love the sound because it's quite melancholy, and I quite like melancholy music, and no surprises there. And it's but it's got this really good sound. It sounds like something from the 80s when I was a teenager, like
right.
something a bit like sort of Don Henley or
okay.
I don't know, the Bangles or something like that. It's just got a really I love the sound of it. The
like a bright, a nice bright 80s sound to it. Yeah, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. Okay, well, that'll be your walk-off music for the show. So we'll be playing that anyway. Finally, James, is there a book that you would recommend that people? It doesn't have to be a business book. It could be any type of book.
Yeah, I don't. There wouldn't be a business book. I don't think I've ever read a business book.
And oh, I'm fantastic answer.
I mean, probably the last book that I read that was most memorable and I really, really loved was a book called English Passengers by Matthew Neal. And it's an almost Dickensian story. It's a story of a set in about the 1850s, and it's a British clipper ship down in Australia that's and the crew have fallen on hard times, and they take a charter, which is to take a group of people to Tasmania, but it's a Dickensian group of passengers that they have.
Oh wow.
All with various motifs, you know, from, you know, someone that wants to an evangelist that wants to convert the indigenous people of Tasmania to Christianity, to a very, very suspect sort of eugenics academic who wants to study racial differences and so on. And it's all about sort of colonialism and colonial attitudes, but done with a huge amount of sort of ribald humor and human insights. Very emotional at the same time. So it's a really good read.
Oh, well, that sounds fantastic. And I've got to credit you. That's fantastic that you don't like business books. What is it that you particularly don't like about them? Is it just because they're too prescriptive?
I think someone said to me that the brilliant thing about this industry is that it's pretty flat in the sense of it's not terribly hierarchical. And even when you're fairly young and inexperienced, you get to work with some people who have great talents and great insights and so on. And they said to me, just stand close to good people and some of it will rub off. And that's been, I mean, I've learned so much from people I've worked with, and all of the lessons that I think made me better didn't come through that sort of more academic way of reading about business. They came from observing talented people and going, I see that's how it works. Right. And that's a way of cracking a problem like that. And so I just think that the power of osmosis. And I think it's one of the great things of, you know, graduating from being at school and college and so on, where you're sort of factory farmed, full of information and so on, to suddenly just being surrounded by experience and insight and talent and just absorbing it when you can.
Well, I got to say, I mean, it's been magnificent to be able to hear your advice, and you know, likewise, I feel like I've a little bit of that's going to rub off on me. So that's fantastic, and thank you very much for doing this, James. And I feel very, very blessed to have spent some time in with you, and thank you very much. I mean, but I was going to wish you luck, but there's no point because it does seem to be, you know, part of your makeup. So long may it continue, whatever your magic recipe is.
Don't take anything for granted. That's part of the recipe.
Okay, well, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing how you and the NCA team carry on breaking boundaries and redefining the creative industry and doing it all in your own way. And more importantly, helping us all fall back in love with the creative industry. So thank you very much, James. Thanks for coming on the show. Take care.
Thanks for your time. Bye.
What a gentleman. It truly was an honour to speak to James, and I hope you all enjoyed listening to his wise words and that a bit of his love for the industry rubbed off on you too. My thanks to you, James, and to the legendary Tim Lindsay for putting in a good word for me, to Rosie Crombie for setting the interview up, and to my doctor for the Valium I needed after the show. Also, thanks to Team Fuel. That's Matt, Donna, Peter, and especially you, our wonderful listeners. Thank you all so very much for helping us grow. Fuel is a proud member of the Marketing Podcast Network, and if you like this show, you should check out all the others at marketingpodcasts.net. That's podcasts with an S. Or look in the show notes at www.thefuelpodcast.com. Ta-da for now. We'll be back next week on Fuel, the podcast for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you? I'm a Smith called Keith, and you're listening to Fuel, where sales and marketing never sounded so good. Visit thefuelpodcast.com for all our shows.